I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're in Congress's August pause before it decides up or down on President Obama's signature stroke in foreign affairs, the deal with Iran to get off the path to nuclear weapons. So let's have at the issues. Issues that citizens on Boston Common seem very alert about this week, one way and the other.
I think giving the Iranian regime $150 billion to unfreeze those assets is a bad idea. I think that money is going to go right towards funding terrorists.
The U.S.-Iran deal, I'm for making any kind of peace we can with Iran. I think we've held them under the water too long, and I think we see the kind of blowback. You know, look what we did to Cuba. Look what we've done to a lot of these places. It's just not, it's not pretty. Is this like medieval siege craft? You know what I mean?
I think the Iran deal is really important. I'm proud of President Obama. I think that trying to normalize relations with the country is going to go a long way for the common person in Iran.
I think any hint from the United States that we're moving away from a militaristic attitude and more towards a democratic one cannot hurt.
Just the word nuclear is a deterrent for anybody to use them.
I think that there is the threat that they will promote terrorism in the region. I think there's a threat to Israel. But, you know, I think progress is moving forward and you know, trying new things.
I'm hoping it's a means to an end. But then we can trust them. Trust is a big word, though.
We've got a variety of interested voices on tap this hour, though we would have had enough just getting inside the skeptical head of our lead guest, Gary Seymour of Harvard's Kennedy School. For 4 years in the Obama White House, he was the president's WMD czar, meaning chief watchdog of nuclear proliferation and weapons of mass destruction in general. For the last 2 years, he's been head of a private letterhead and lobbying group called United Against a Nuclear Iran, which has come out politely and firmly against this deal. But then this month, Dr. Seymour quit the United Against presidency because on balance, he says, this deal is a good one, especially considering the alternatives. What if, Dr. Seymour, this whole story is told in your own slow move from the uncertain center to a decisive leap in favor? And let me just say, we're thrilled to see you, to have you in the House to explain everything.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I mean, for me, I was skeptical that an agreement would emerge because Supreme Leader Khamenei had laid out many public red lines, which I knew would be unacceptable to the United States. But in April, at the meeting in Switzerland, in Lausanne, the negotiators announced parameters that indicated that Iran was prepared to accept much more significant limits on their nuclear program and additional inspections. And then, of course, the final agreement in July codified that and added some additional details. So when I sat down and looked at the pros and cons, the strengths and weaknesses of the deal as it emerged, to me, it deals with the problem at least for the next 15 years, assuming that the agreement survives and that Iran complies. And I think that's a pretty significant achievement in terms of putting off the problem and gambling that in the course of those 15 years we'll see a change or evolution in the government in Iran that might be less committed to acquiring nuclear weapons.
There's a personal story here in your case, and I hope you're keeping the notes for the big book on it. You've been struggling with the Iran question since Reagan time, 30 years in and out of government. I want to know, how are we feeling about this point in the marathon? What's our emotion? Yours, that is.
So look, I have always thought that our policy was essentially one of delay, that we were not going to persuade the Iranian government, the Iranian leaders, that nuclear weapons were a bad thing. For reasons of their own, they see them as important, or at least the option to produce nuclear weapons, to defend themselves against the great Satan and to assert Iran's primacy in the region. So our policy has mainly been based on trying to prolong their effort, to postpone their ability to produce nuclear weapons. And we've used a variety of tools, from sabotage to sanctions to export controls, military threats, and diplomacy. And I see this agreement as another element in a game of delay, except a 15 years is a pretty good delay, much better than we could achieve through most other instruments.
I'm just thinking as one, and you're a lot younger than I am, but we're old enough to remember Audley North taking a cake with a key in it to Tehran. I mean, from those times, we would seem to have come a long way.
Well, that's the interesting question. I mean, we know within Iran there are certainly proponents of better relations with the United States, opening to the world, political reform at home or social mm-hmm. freedoms and so forth. We know there's a very large group of younger people who are resentful of the restrictions that the theocracy has imposed. Whether and how they will prevail is very unclear. I mean, Iranian politics is incredibly complicated and convoluted and difficult to penetrate.
So is American politics, if you've noticed recently.
I think Iranian politics is even worse. But in any event, you know, you do have these contesting forces within Iran. And one question is whether this nuclear deal will empower those moderates and pragmatists who are trying to push reform and a more moderate foreign policy in the long term, or whether it will help to entrench the hardliners. And we just don't know the answer to that. And that's really the gamble of this deal.
We're going to guess on that before the hour is out. But come back to sort of a simple two layers of this deal. One is the nuclear mechanics themselves, but then the bet on Iran and the present government's behavior in the world. What is your calculation about what this does to Iran's profile in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, elsewhere?
My bet is that we won't see any near-term significant change in Iran's behavior because, as Supreme Leader Khamenei has said, this is simply a transactional agreement to get sanctions relief in exchange for accepting limits on the nuclear program. And he continues to say that Iran will stand up against the United States and its friends in the region, meaning Israel and Saudi Arabia. So I wouldn't expect to see any dramatic transformation. Now, whether or not that – of course, that doesn't mean there won't be areas of where we can cooperate with Iran. I mean, in the case of Iraq, we're tacitly cooperating with Iran against the Islamic State, even though we have very different ideas for what the future of Iraq will look like. John Kerry is hoping that he'll be able to build on the nuclear agreement to work with Iran and Russia to bring about a peace settlement in Syria. I'm very skeptical that will happen because I think the situation on the ground doesn't really make one very optimistic that that can happen. But we'll see whether or not the Iranians are willing to work with us on issues like Syria. But overall, I wouldn't expect there to be a near-term transformation in Iran's foreign policy. They'll continue to support Hezbollah. They'll continue to support Assad. They'll continue to call for the destruction of Israel. They'll continue to try to undermine Saudi influence, including in Yemen. And I think we have to recognize that the nuclear deal doesn't really solve all problems. We're going to have to continue to deal with what we consider to be Iran's aggression in the region.
But is it a major flaw that it didn't deal with Iran's performance, as you say, in Syria particularly?
I don't think so, because I don't think that's attainable. I mean, I think going back to President Bush, the U.S. decided that the nuclear issue was of such paramount importance in terms of the threat that a nuclear-armed Iran would pose to the U.S. and to our allies in the region, that it made sense to pursue a diplomatic approach that isolated the nuclear issue and tried to solve the nuclear issue without bringing in all of these other problems, which in many ways are even more difficult. And I think Obama's followed in that overall strategy of trying to solve the nuclear problem, recognizing that we're going to continue to have disputes with Iran on a range of issues separate from the nuclear issue.
You don't profess that it's perfect. What are your reservations about it? And what improvements can you imagine you'd have made in an ideal case or even now practically?
Well, I think we made two really big concessions. One is that we allowed Iran to retain a more substantial enrichment program than we had originally sought. So in our opening negotiating position, we were demanding that Iran give up all but a few hundred centrifuges and not have any research and development on more advanced machines. In the final deal, we've accepted several thousand centrifuges, and we've allowed Iran to have some limited but nonetheless continuing research and development on more advanced centrifuges. The second big concession we made was on duration. We had originally, going back to the first U.S. position, was that the limits would stay in place until Iran had changed its behavior. Then we said 20 to 25 years. We've now ended up with 10 to 15 years. But those are concessions that the negotiators felt they had to make in order to get a deal. And I don't think you can go back and unwind those. It's very difficult to second guess the decisions people made at the negotiating table. So those that are calling for a substantially better deal, I'm not sure that's practical in terms of what we'd be able to achieve, given the amount of economic and political pressure we were able to use as leverage to get the deal we have.
So what are the alternatives to this deal that it is better than? I mean, what else? What else could have, you know, been chosen?
So the critics argue we should reject this agreement, we should go back to the policy of sanctions and pressure and try to negotiate a better deal. And when they say better deal, they mean more physical restrictions on Iran's capabilities, fewer centrifuges and so forth, longer duration or unlimited duration, and stronger inspections. For example, anytime, anywhere inspections. As I said, I'm not sure those are achievable objectives with the leverage we have available. And of course, if we reject this agreement, it'll be difficult to sustain the same kind of international coalition that Bush and then Obama put together to put economic pressure on Iran. And the risk is that we'll be in a situation where we'll have less leverage, less support for international sanctions, and the Iranians will be free to move ahead with their nuclear program to unfreeze the activities that were currently frozen under the interim agreement. Now, at the end of the day, that might produce another round of negotiations, but I'm not sure it produces a substantially better deal.
Our guest is Dr. Gary Seymour of the Belfer Center at Harvard. He's spent a first half of his professional lifetime thinking hard about Iran and nuclear weapons. Stephen Ever of MIT will join us as we continue. Coming up, the editor of the venerable and vocal Jewish Forward is telling us about her own unfinished inquiry into Iran and this deal. Don't go away. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. I was fascinated this week to read a fine reporting piece from Iran in the old and influential Jewish Forward. The author was Larry Kohler Esses, the first journalist from self-designated Jewish media to visit Iran since the revolution in 1979. On the street, in the marketplaces of Iran, he found much wider varieties of opinion, more boldly spoken than most of us would have expected. So I asked his editor, Jane Eisner, just why she had sent him, what she had learned, and how she was forming her own editorial statement on the Iran nuclear deal. This was Jane Eisner on the phone this week.
He found Iranians to be much more open than we had expected. He found people who could talk freely, even critically, about the government and the regime, about its controversial policies and behaviors. For example, there was a lot of criticism of the Iran-Iraq war. I think that there's suspicion among many Iranians that he spoke with who don't think that the benefits of a deal, if it should be approved, will accrue to them. There's the same resentment about corruption and inequality in that country as we have here. That was the big eye-opener for us, how freely people spoke with their criticism of the regime, past and present. And that was not what we had expected from a state that we had been told all along is a kind of totalitarian regime there. I think it's important, though, for us to also listen to the voices of the clerics whom Larry talked to, some of whom still had a very, very hard-line, uncompromising position about Israel and about what they saw as the Iranian role in the future. And it was a mixed bag. You like to believe that this is a country that is interested in moving ahead, in dealing with the problems of its citizens, in opening up to the world. It's very educated. It's very urbane in many ways. And you think, like, okay, this could work. And then there are other interviews which left me chilled. I mean, left me really, really concerned about who is going to be in charge and what are they going to be doing in the future with weaponry or nuclear capability. And that distinction, I think, between the people and what Larry calls the deep state is really difficult. It's fascinating. It's kind of unknowable.
So take us into your own head, forming an editorial opinion for Jewish Forward on the deal.
Well, it's still a work in progress in my head. Where I have been pretty outspoken, my editorials, is expressing dismay by the tenor of the conversation in the Jewish community. Hmm. And I think that there are responsible ways for different voices to shape the deal and shape the debate. But I don't think it should become a litmus test for Jewish identity or for someone's love and support of Israel. Good people can disagree on this. We see that even in the state of Israel, whereas while the elected leaders there seem pretty uniformly against the deal, more and more members of the security and military establishment are saying that it should be supported. So I think that what we need to do as a community is to model a really good debate, to learn as much as we can from different points of view, and also to figure out what is the best way to shape this.
You know, at this point, before Labor Day, what's the biggest reason to think favorably about the deal? What's your gravest reservation about it?
There are many reasons to think favorably about the deal. It does postpone the chance for Iran to work on a nuclear weapon for at least 10 to 15 years. It puts pretty rigorous inspections in place. It was achieved through diplomacy, not through any sort of military means, and it has the backing of the world. Hmm. Not only the nations that participated in the negotiations, but the United Nations as well. And so it could mark a turning point. We certainly saw in Larry's reporting many people in the country really eager to be part of the West, part of the world, and that could have a real ameliorating effect on the dangerous aspects of that country's regime. Hmm. You know, what worries me is that that's a big unknown, and we don't know. We don't know whether the reformers will be in place in 10 or 15 years or whether the regime will remain the way it has been in the last many, many years. And that gives me a lot of pause. I need to look more carefully at some of the non-nuclear aspects of the deal and the weaponry that Iran is allowed to get. I think, you know, the critics make a good point, too, about how quickly sanction relief is given and how much money there is there and whether or not there would be a way of making sure that it's used for good and not bad purposes. So that's where my head is now. Mm. That's what I hear as the best arguments for and against. And I think that it's important for us to listen to especially the nuclear experts in the United States and Israel, who know a whole lot more about this than I do. There seems to be a growing consensus among them that this is a good deal, and that is also something that I take into serious considerations as I think about how the Forward should respond.
That was Jane Eisner of the Jewish Forward. Gary Seymour from the Kennedy School. In our own councils, we were wondering this week, how would Congress and how would we feel about the Iran deal if Israel didn't care one way or the other? But of course, Israel does care, and most vocally, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has been urging American Jews to fight the deal. The tilt of Jewish members of Congress, the very senior Sandra Levin of Michigan in the House, for example, who's for the deal, but even more so Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, who's against it. These things get followed minutely. Comes the question, Gary Seymour, is this deal good for Israel? And how do we weigh even that question?
So I've been in a number of meetings with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I think he is genuinely afraid that this agreement would pose an existential threat to Israel because it would allow Iran to retain nuclear capacity even in the long term. And he believes that if Iran has nuclear weapons, that would pose a threat to the survival of the Israeli state. But as Jane said, a number of other Israeli experts, people in the military and the intelligence services and the diplomatic services, think that this agreement is acceptable and that they believe that it's in Israel's interests. So at the end of the day, Israel being a democracy just like the United States, they're going to have to resolve that issue for themselves. I mean, every country has a responsibility and an obligation to make a decision about its national interests. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu may believe that there's a chance that Congress will overturn the agreement. But even if Congress fails to overturn the agreement, he wants to be on record as opposing this agreement so that Israel has a free hand in the future. You know, if the agreement collapses, if Iran cheats or reneges on it, he wants to make it clear that Israel can act on its own behalf, including, if necessary, the use of military force.
Can I say, and not lightly, I mean, if I had a moment with Prime Minister Netanyahu, I'd want to ask him, what about Israel's existential threat to Iran, or certainly the threat that Iran feels existentially from nuclear Israel? Has anybody asked him that?
Well, I mean, to be fair, the Israeli government does not call for the elimination of Iran as a state, unlike the Iranian government, which calls for the elimination of Israel as a Jewish state.
But I also read Sheldon Adelson, you know, who was, you know, a main supporter of the United States against nuclear Iran, et cetera. I mean, he says at the drop of a hat, you know, just nuke them, you know, get it done. There are all sorts of existential and other violent threats out there, and they're not all to be taken quite literally, right? Or,
well, I mean, Sheldon Adelson doesn't speak for the Israeli government, so I mean, I do think it's a fair point from an Israeli standpoint, and whether you take Iran's rhetoric seriously or not is another matter, but at least as a matter of rhetoric, Iran calls for the elimination of Israel as a Jewish state. So you can't ignore that if you're the leader or a security person in Israel.
Fair enough. It's a pleasure to introduce Steve Van Evera. Introduce him again. He's a political scientist and historian at MIT. He's also a journalist and a citizen and a friend of Open Source. Steve, you keep telling me this is a very, very big deal, and we got to keep talking about it. Where's to start on the Van Evera brief?
I think the whole nuclear future of the Middle East is at stake here.
Nuclear, non-nuclear?
Yeah. In other words, you can imagine, you know, two ends of a dipole where things can come out in the Middle East. You're going to have a Middle East with very few weapons of mass destruction, or you can have a Middle East with lots of them, and lots of them in very dangerous hands. The scariest scenario that we should focus on is that Iran will get weapons, and that will set off a domino effect in which other powers that I think are even less reliable as custodians of these weapons will get them.
Like the Saudis?
Yeah, the Saudis have said very clearly, if Iran moves toward nukes, we will do it too. And I'm much more worried about the Saudis as a nuclear power than I am about the Iranians, because the Saudi state is shot through with radicals who have close ties to Sunni jihadists who have made clear they intend to take WMD against the West if they can acquire it, which Iran has not done. And then there's a further proliferation that I think would unfold if this all happened. Egypt is going to look at a nuclear weapon, and they also have a security establishment that's not reliable, and other powers too. So we have a possible very bad future here that I think we have a chance to prevent. And we have to be clear-headed now about whether this agreement moves the ball forward in preventing it or not.
Start with the Netanyahu objections to this deal, but then your own view and your own vote on the deal that's been negotiated.
Well, I think that Netanyahu's scenario is very unlikely. The idea that Iran is going to use nuclear weapons against Israel is extremely small, because Iran has a powerful nuclear deterrent. Everyone knows it will use it. The much more dangerous scenario—
Israel does.
Yes, sorry. Israel has it. The much more dangerous scenario for Israel is a nuclear proliferated Mideast in which Al-Qaeda or other Islamist nihilist actors acquire WMD who also have Israel in their crosshairs. I believe myself, I know many Israelis who disagree, but I believe Al-Qaeda is the most dangerous threat to Israel, not just to the United States. Israelis don't, you know, think that way, but they are in al-Qaeda's crosshairs too. So this long-term danger of nukes in the hands of very bad actors is a scenario that Netanyahu also should worry about, not the more immediate, you know, Iran will nuke Israel, but rather that these weapons will come to pervade the environment and fall into very bad hands.
Why did Iran want this agreement now, in your view, Steve Inibra?
I think they want to – well, I can't read their minds, and I kind of don't care why. In other words, if this is a good deal, we should do it. If it's not a good deal, we shouldn't do it. I think that in part, though, this is them conceding to the coercion of the world and to Western sanctions. We should understand that our policy of, if you will, firm coercion, especially as applied recently, you know, through the sanctions. We've applied very tough sanctions to Iran in the last several years. And Iran is deciding that they want to escape those sanctions and come in from the cold and establish a normal relationship, or a more normal economic relationship with the West. And so, you know, one way to look at this is, you know, we should accept the victory, take yes for an answer here. Let's harvest the benefit of our coercive policy.
You reminded me that in 2003, during our Bush administration, G.W. Bush, Iran made maybe an even more generous capitulation or a whiter white flag that would have tied up a nuclear agreement with recognition of Israel, and maybe behavior modification too. Where are we on that historical line? And I want Gary's view too.
They made noises suggesting they wanted to talk about everything. They wanted to put everything on the table, quote unquote, including their behavior toward Israel, their behavior toward terror, and their nuclear program. This was in April, May 2003. And the talks never happened because the Bush administration didn't want to talk. And I think that was a big blunder. I think we should have talked then, partly because we probably could have gotten a better deal then. Their program was much smaller then, and we had much of a less of a distance to move them then than we do now. I think there were really three occasions back then when the Iranians seemed to want to talk. You never know if people are serious, but they seemed to want to talk. Late 2001, spring 2003, and then there was a period a little while after that. And one implication for that now is if we were to walk away from the talks today, let's understand the, I think, likelihood that if we ever did go back to talking, we would face an even more robust Iranian nuclear program and a tougher job rolling it back than we face today.
Gary Seymour, you were in England during the Bush administration, but you were still preoccupied with Iran questions. Why didn't the 2003 nibble, you know, get picked up?
Well, I think, you know, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq had a very powerful effect on Iran's leaders, who thought they were next. And they did a number
of
things.
Dick Cheney thought so too, right?
Certainly people in the Bush administration were advocating the use of military force. And the Iranians did a number of things to try to deflect that military threat. They declared a number of nuclear activities and facilities that were previously secret and put them under international inspection. They made overtures to the United States, as Steve said, which was rejected by the Bush administration. They made overtures to the Europeans and actually came to an agreement for 2 years to freeze their nuclear program. It was really our getting bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq that led the Iranians to conclude that it was safe for them to renege on the agreement they had with the Europeans. And in 2005 and 2006, when Ahmadinejad was actually elected president, so the Iranians walked away from that deal with the Europeans, and they calculated correctly that the Bush administration was too preoccupied with problems in Iraq and Afghanistan to use military force. Instead, the Bush administration tried to pursue diplomacy using really the same dual-track strategy that Obama used, offering a deal on one hand, trying to increase sanctions on the other. I think Obama was able to build on that dual-track strategy much more effectively, in part because he didn't have the baggage that Bush had, and in part because Obama was able to demonstrate that the Iranians were not serious about diplomacy, at least in the first term. And that, I think, is part of the reason why Rouhani was elected president in 2013 and the Iranians became more serious about negotiating a deal.
In 2003, let's remember, the Iranians didn't foresee that they would be strategic beneficiaries of our war in Iraq either.
Absolutely. I mean, at the time, it looked like the U.S. was on the march in the Middle East. I mean, we very quickly won the war in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think the Iranians were genuinely afraid that if they misbehaved or gave the U.S. any casus belli, they would be next and we would march on Tehran.
But so should we spin that out to a notion that Iran's position is in fact strengthening regardless of this deal and that this is a good time to be concluding an agreement?
Well, you know, look, I think the deal has to stand on the merits. I mean, one could, you know, right now Iran has some advantages in the Middle East relative to other regional players, mainly because of the Arab Spring, which has really led to chaos and turmoil throughout the Arab world. You have no government in Libya, no government in Syria, or a weak government in Syria, no government in Yemen. Egypt is preoccupied with its domestic problems. Iraq is obviously splintered. So the Iranians, to some extent, have been moving into that vacuum. But I am not one of those who think that the Iranians are in a position to dominate the region. At the end of the day, they're a Shia Persian power in a Sunni Arab Middle East, and there are limits to how far they can expand their influence.
Steve, would you say still seize the moment? This is a good time to be making a deal with a rebounding Iran?
Yes, I would, if it's a good deal. And I think a key question here is, you know, how do you measure whether this deal has moved the ball forward? I think it has. And I'd love to hear more from Gary about sort of the key puzzles I think you have to, you know, parse to figure out if it has moved the ball forward.
Give us all time, including Gary, to catch our breath. Coming up, can you make a good deal with bad people? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, sampling the arguments around the nuclear weapons deal with Iran. Congress votes on it after Labor Day. Gary Seymour is our guest from the Kennedy School at Harvard. There's the deal, and then there's this question, contested question of Iran as a recognized player in the region from here on. The most urgent test of Iran's bad behavior today may be Syria. The gruesome slaughter of Syrian civilians by the Assad regime, their nominal government, could not continue without Iran's weapons and Iran's help. Nader Hashemi is a scholar at the University of Denver, of Iranian heritage himself, but militantly opposed to the Iranian government, especially for its hand in the Syrian killing. And still, he supports this no-nukes deal. I asked him this week, how do you make a good deal with bad people?
Well, I think Iran is the biggest backer of the Assad regime today. It has invested billions of dollars. We don't know the full sum yet. Had Iran not supported the Assad regime and then it increased its support over the course of the war, the Assad regime would have fallen by now. And in fact, Iran's deputy foreign minister, in a lecture at the University of Tehran about 6 months ago, publicly acknowledged this fact when he said that in 2013, the tide of the war was going against the Assad regime. We stepped up our intervention and we kept that regime alive. So Iran is the biggest backer. And Iran also, I would argue, has a lot of blood on its hands because all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity that have characterized the behavior of the Assad regime could only have happened because of the support that Tehran is giving it. I think this is going to be one of the darkest chapters in Iranian foreign policy when there's an opportunity in Tehran to have a full debate and disclosure over this. So Iran has really been playing, I think, from a human rights perspective, a very criminal role in sustaining the Assad regime. But of course, it's doing it because it views its own national security doctrine to be at risk should the Assad regime fall. It knows quite well that the successor to the Assad regime will likely be a regime that will be very sympathetic to its regional rivals, principally Saudi Arabia, and antagonistic to Iran's interests. And of course, its biggest fear is that a successor regime to Assad would cut off access to its major sort of area of influence where it could project its power, and that is Hezbollah in Lebanon. So Iran has a lot invested And I don't think Syria is really a victory for Iran. In many ways, it's emerging as a major defeat because it spent billions of dollars on a regime that's dying. If you listen to the rhetoric coming out of Tehran, they say they are still committed to supporting all of its regional allies, particularly the Assad regime. But I think events on the ground are starting to change, and it's going to force Iran to sort of rethink how much more money it wants to throw at a regime that doesn't have a long shelf life.
Argue that point that a deal with a nasty regime that you don't like is somehow going to inhibit or restrain their deeply bad mischief in Syria.
All bad regimes live within a particular context. And the context that Iran is facing is it's ruling over a population that does not support it. It has an economy that effectively has collapsed. Much of the financial windfall that it's going to get from this nuclear deal is going to have to be spent on its domestic needs and reviving its energy sector. And anything left over will be invested in making sure that Iranian foreign policy in the Middle East is strong. That's primarily Iraq, primarily, I think, trying to fight the war against ISIS, which I think is a big game changer, the rise of ISIS. So yes, I mean, broadly speaking, I think a more engaged policy by the international community toward Tehran is the right policy. The policy of containment, of threatening Iran with military strikes, of ratcheting up the rhetoric, plays into the worst elements within the Iranian political establishment, the hardliners, the Revolutionary Guards, and it undermines the more pragmatic and moderate forces within the Iranian ruling elite. The final point that I'd like to make, and this has been, I think, ignored in the debate, is that the future of Iran politically over the next 15 years matters now much more than it did prior to the signing of this nuclear agreement, because the general assumption is that within 15 years, the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program will start to lift gradually. And that raises the question, where will Iran be 15 years from now? And I think there's a lot of room for cautious optimism that Iran is ripe for a gradual but very profound political transformation in the direction of democracy, which could be a complete game changer. And I think that's something that needs greater attention. And in fact, that's actually the primary reason why I'm supportive of the Iran nuclear deal, because I think it's good for the struggle for democracy in Iran. It's good for the human rights community in Iran. It's good for civil society in Iran, because the sanctions that will be lifted, the resuscitation of the economy, will give them much more breathing room and wiggle room to press for their democratic demands. And I think that's really the biggest Achilles heel that the Iranian regime faces, the crisis of legitimacy that it faces in the eyes of its own population.
That was Nader Hashemi at the University of Denver. Our conversation is with Gary Seymour of Harvard and Steve Anivra of MIT. Who wants to argue that the West, the United States, has more leverage on Iran's behavior? They have more to gain with this deal than without.
So the Iranians, if they want this deal to survive, which means if they want the sanctions relief to continue, they have to be careful not to do things that could potentially upset the agreement. Now that, again, doesn't mean they're going to fundamentally change their behavior in the region, but it might temper some of their actions if they calculate that those actions could lead to the agreement collapsing. So I think it may, you know, it may moderate some of their behavior. But as I said, I wouldn't expect a transformation in Iran's actions in the region, at least in the near term.
Not transformation, but what about just plain incentives? Just the fact that we're talking, that they're in halfway into the club.
You know, I think the big problem on Syria, and I, you know, agreed with your guess that Iran's primary interest is maintaining a government in Damascus that will allow them to continue to support Hezbollah, with which there are very deep theological ties. I don't see a formula given the players on the ground, especially the strength of al-Nusra and Islamic State, to have a political settlement that will guarantee such a government in Damascus. So for that reason, I'm very skeptical that the Iranians can afford to abandon Assad to some transitional process that leads to Assad leaving.
Steve Anivra, would you argue that arms agreements and the talks to, you know, to write them soften enmities and even soften the regimes over there?
I'm a general believer that extreme regimes are probably moderated by pulling them into the discourse with the wider world.
But what's the evidence?
The best evidence is the impact of arms control on Gorbachev new thinking. It's pretty clear that the Soviet elites who came west and engaged in the arms control dialogues of the 70s and 80s were very demoralized about their own system by their contact with the West. They really, many of them kind of came west and realized, oh my gosh, you know, we've been told lots of lies about economics, about the attitude of the West, about the way the world works, about our own conduct. Maybe there's something fundamentally wrong with our own regime. There was really a sort of paradigm shattering event that happened with the echelon of elites just below the top. And those new thinkers, if you will, were a major reason why the Soviets in the end decided to end the Cold War. So it's kind of like, you know, winning the war through a loving embrace. I'm predicting the same thing with Cuba, that I think the best way to bring Castro down is the kind of engagement we're engaging with, because it will demoralize the and change the minds, change the paradigms of the sort of second echelon folks who wind up doing the engaging. Now, whether that'll happen with Iran or not, I don't know. You know, it's, I wouldn't count on it. But I would say you don't, this deal doesn't require that that happen. We needn't assume that that will happen. To me, I think we should simply look at this deal saying, assume that the regime won't change, won't improve. It, does this deal improve things? We need to sort of measure whether it improves the situation on the main dimensions we care about. Does it move Iran further from having a bomb today? Does it give us the ability to, if you will, coerce Iran into following the deal? In other words, if the deal is followed, are things better? Do we have the means to ensure that Iran follows the deal? Do we have the means to verify if they're following it? And do we have the coercive means to encourage them to follow it? And then at the end of the deal, as Gary was saying, this deal does not go on forever. We wish it did, but it won't. At the end of the deal, will we have the means to keep Iran going on the right path? Does it, will we have the information to know if they're behaving the way we want? And will we have the coercive instruments to keep them headed the right direction? For me, this deal checks all three boxes. It moves Iran further from a bomb today. It leaves us with the capacity to know if they are carrying out their commitments. It leaves us with the coercive capacity to give them incentives to carry out their commitments. And down the road, I think it leaves us with a pretty good capacity to know if they're going the way we want and a capacity to take action if they're not. I'd love to know more from Gary, though, if he thinks that's true.
I'm dying to ask. 1, 2, 3. Gary, say more.
Well, I agree that for the next 15 years, the agreement gives us very good means to both monitor Iran's activity and physical constraints on that, on those activities. The risk comes after 15 years, when most of the physical limits and most of the special inspection measures expire. At that point, if Iran still is interested in developing nuclear weapons, it could be much more difficult for us to manage it. If they comply with the agreement and then begin to expand their nuclear program, giving them more options to become a threshold state or to actually develop nuclear weapons, it could be more difficult for us to mobilize international support against them. I mean, it's very speculative because it depends so much on the character of Iran's government at that point and their relations with the U.S. and the Western countries and other countries. So you can't predict, but I'm just saying the sunset clause, the 15-year sunset clause, could potentially put us in a difficult position, but I'm prepared to gamble or trade that risk for getting 15 years of constraint.
What about the benefit, though, of the inspection regime that will give us visibility into the nature of their nuclear activities? We'll know more about what they're doing, where they're doing it, and therefore what action we would need to take, either military or economic, to stop them. Now, as I'm imagining, you know, the U.S. Air Force will be more able to take action in 15 years under this deal than not.
Well, that may be true at year 15, but once some of the special inspection provisions expire and the limits on their nuclear program expire, at year 20 or 25, we may be in a much weaker position. But again, that's so far in the future that I don't think you can base policy on such an uncertain, distant future.
I just want to play bubble-headed citizen here, wild-eyed optimist, eager traveler. What if something really changes? What if millions of Americans who've never dared to go to Iran flock at long last to the cities of Isfahan, for example? That would be my first landing. And discover, as our man Larry from the Jewish Forward did, that these are friendly people. They're well-educated. They're wildly interested in American life and culture, as we ought to be in their cuisine, in their theater, in their cinema. Why shouldn't all that change? If not overnight, but 10 years is a long time.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's exactly what Khamenei's nightmare is. The last thing he wants is to have, you know, Iran's revolutionary culture contaminated by too much contact with Americans. So you have a push and pull. You have on one hand his interest in trying to prevent subversion through too much contact with the U.S. On the other hand, you have a yearning among many Iranians to have greater contact. And this will play out over 10 to 15 years. You know, we're not going to go to sleep for 15 years, right? We're going to be monitoring what happens, both in terms of Iran's domestic politics and its regional policy, as well as its nuclear program. So we'll be in a position to gauge whether the agreement is having the desired effect or not.
I got two questions before we're done. For Gary Seymour, most of the people in the world live in nuclear-free zones. Latin America, for example, East Asia, Africa. Have you ever had it on your own personal bucket list to see a nuclear-free Middle East?
I think the Middle East will be the last zone in the world to become nuclear-free. You know, we should recognize there's always been tremendous pressure for nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. Israel, of course, was the first, but four Arab countries have tried and failed to develop nuclear weapons: Egypt, Libya, Syria, Iraq. Now Iran has pursued a nuclear weapons effort for many, many years. That's going to continue because the nature of politics in the Middle East is very militarized, very conflictual, and in that kind of a an environment where security and military power is important, nuclear weapons are attractive. So to me, with or without a deal, there's going to be pressure for further proliferation.
Stick around and keep working on it. But here's a question for you, Steve, but for everybody, and that's the American profile in this whole process, long and patient, embodied now in the sort of the long jaw of John Kerry. Can we stand this image of ourselves listening, holding our fire, talking, bargaining, compromising, working things out? That to me is the most interesting, and it showed up on the Boston Common too, the most interesting transformation here. And it's not transformation, but evolution, and we like it. I do.
Well, you know, was it Churchill who said, it's better to jaw-jaw than to wah-wah? And the bad thing about jaw-jaw is it always takes a long time, and you know, the video isn't good on CNN, and so it's not as fun to watch. And it requires patience, and it requires, frankly, a lot of public attention, too, because it's the kind of activity that requires sustained, consistent policy, and you can't have that if you don't have, you know, a somewhat engaged public and a Congress that's willing to spend time and think and people willing to read stuff and know stuff and be patient. That's what required. This is a long, as Gary said, this project of denuking Iran is a very long project. Managing proliferation in the Middle East, very long project. Can't be solved overnight. No one should think it can be. You know, everyone should be counseled that, you know, this takes patience and lots of willingness to sustain energy over time.
And it does not comport with at least the theater of the Republican candidates on parade on Fox News either. But who's to say it isn't a deeply possible trend in our own life? What do you think, Gary?
Well, I think certainly our allies are very worried about what they see as the partisanship of the polarization of domestic politics in the U.S. over issues of security and foreign policy, which traditionally have tended to be more bipartisan for the most part. And I think they're nervous that even if this deal survives, which most people think it will because Obama's veto will not be overridden, I think they're nervous about whether the next administration will be able to sustain it and whether there'll be sort of a constant guerrilla warfare against the agreement that will undercut it. And, you know, I think part of the question of American leadership is whether we can sustain policies that require patience and, you know, long-term vision. That is not something our European friends necessarily see from us.
Those are two important premises. One, that the deal will not, that the veto will not be overridden, and two, that we have another dangerous surge of activist foreign policy impulses in our politics. So what's the next assignment for the sane professionals like you? What's your next hurdle?
Well, I think getting this deal in place is going to require a lot of work. Assuming that Congress passes a resolution of disapproval, which I think is very likely, assuming Obama vetoes it, assuming that the veto is not overridden, then the really hard work will begin. It'll be months before the Iranians take the necessary nuclear steps to trigger sanctions relief, and there are bound to be compliance and implementation issues, because this agreement, like any complicated agreement, has a number of ambiguities in it. There'll be areas of contention. At the same time that we're implementing the agreement, we'll continue to be partly cooperating, partly, you know, conflicting with the Iranians on a range of regional issues. And the next administration is really going to inherit most of the responsibility for sustaining the agreement.
In the meantime, let's take an open source field trip to Tehran and Isfahan and the rest of that mysterious land. And thank you, Gary Seymour, for your work and for this conversation. Thank you, Steve Enevra, as always. Thanks also to Jane Eisner and Nader Hashemi. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomino, Zach Goldhammer, and Grant Holub-Mormon. Special thanks to our visiting scholar from Glasgow, Mohammed Idris Ahmad. George Hicks engineers our show. Mary McGrath is our centrifuge. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.